cannot possibly know who is the rightful owner, and so on and so on. Therefore, we make it a crude rule of practice and say to restore deposits is an appropriate act. But that is a lower level of reflection, that we drop this distinction. Now, what Cicero is doing in the books, The Offices, deals only with these crude things called the officia in the narrower sense. The katekon, in the katekon meaning the appropriate act as distinguished from the right act. As distinguished from the right act, from the pure, this we must keep in mind. And there, the distinction is in this form a Stoic distinction. And the key concept of the Stoics was a wise man. And this had very much to do with the Socratic teaching, virtue is knowledge. Now, if virtue is knowledge, only the wise man can be virtuous. This is virtue, strictly speaking. But then we must also, as sensible people, allow that there are many people who are not wise, and there is a great difference among them regarding decency and indecency. Therefore, we need a lower conception of virtue, and this is in terms of people who are not wise. Cicero's son, Marcus, was surely not wise at that time. And the father may very well have suspected that he will never become wise in his life. At any rate, he gives him this massive morality, on which all of us must act all of the time, most of the time, but which is not a pure morality. The distinction reminds somehow, although it is not identical, of the Platonic distinction between true virtue and popular virtue. The modus
arete. And long speech, why don't we conclude that he's being just and compelling short speech?
Well, that is not the end problem. Yeah? Which you cannot do when you hear long speech. Where the Athenians, very fair men, say we don't want to make long speeches, make notes of this, and then you miss what he says while you are making the notes. So there is something even on the crude level on top of it, but of course it is clear that sometimes it is absolutely impossible to answer a question without saying, my dear, the question is very ill phrased. You don't make certain distinctions. These words which you use are so ambiguous that you can give all kinds of answers. It's a long speech. But therefore, as stated and as frequently used here by Socrates, it is of course comic, as if it were really like one who can is a good runner, another who a fast runner, another is a slow runner. You know, and then of course, from the point of view of running, naturally, the fast runner should win. But in thinking, it is not so much the fastness or slowness, of course, but the truth. But still, to some extent, the truth, knowledge of the truth, is bound up with a certain kind of slowness, step by step. People who are very clever can do this very fast, but it also must be step by step, nevertheless. Good. Now let us, good. So Socrates, as I said, has one, two, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot you.
I'm still worried about this scene as an illustration of the unity of well-advisedness and justice, or the disunity of Socrates' basic method, stripped to its essentials, is, I think, an unjust one. That is to say, he determines what it is that the company in large wants, which is a continuation of the discussion, and then begins the argument by setting forth as a condition of the continuation of the discussion that it be on his terms.
Yeah.
And despite the twists of the argument, it eventually comes back down to that, and Socrates wins his point. This then is taking advantage of the desires of other people in order to impose his own desires.
You're sure? I believe I admitted that, but I only add this qualification. Why does Socrates do it? Does he do it in order to show off, to win an argument, or does he not have a nobler purpose? And I would say he has obviously a nobler purpose, that indicated by the presence of that silent Hippocrates. And Socrates says, indeed, I mean, that is the point. It is one of these ticklish marginal questions. How far can you go in disregarding justice for the sake of justice? You know, the Robin Hood problem. But one does not understand the problem of justice if one does not take into consideration these marginal problems. As it were, the true problem shows in what seems to be the merely marginal problem. But of course, I mean, I have nothing against the assertion that Socrates acts unjustly, provided you understand, you define the character of his unjust action properly. He cheats in a way, but you know, what is the purpose for which he cheats? That this issue is not settled by the fact is shown very simply. I do not know how much is it. I think we are about in the middle of the dialogue, and the other half is needed to satisfy your reasonable doubts. So I suggest that we go on, Mr. Reinken. Now I would like to say one thing about the next section, which starts at the end of 338 and goes into 347. In this section, Protagoras asks the questions and Socrates answers, as was stipulated by Socrates' law. But the largest part of this section, from the beginning of 342 to the end, consists of one long speech by Socrates, which proves clearly his injustice. Protagoras mustn't make long speeches, strictly forbidden, but Socrates does. Now, let's go on.
He, Protagoras, began to put his questions as follows.
Not as follows, about as follows. That is another indication that this is not a verbatim report. In other words, Socrates, we do not know how much Socrates made up this story while telling it to these comrades. It's also, and well, this is not surprising, because surely Plato made these things up more or less out of pure clothes. And poets are, of course, liars. I mean, if someone, if Tolstoy begins one of his novels and written this way, say, X stood at this window, yeah? Of course he never stood at the window. X never existed. Lie. You will say that's very crude, but it is not always. It has some non-crude implications. Good. Now?
I am of opinion, Socrates, he said, that skill in poetry is the principal part of education. And this I conceive to be the ability to understand.
The principle is perhaps too strong. A very great part can also mean, it is true, the Greek superlative without article can mean both. A very great thing or the greatest. Yes.
And this I conceive to be the ability to understand which compositions of the poets are correct and which are not, and to know how to distinguish between them and, when asked, give the reasons.
Yeah, now, you know, see, Protagoras, why does he turn to the criticism and the interpretation of poetry? Well, it's clear he assumes that in this field he will be superior to Socrates. poetry is somehow more akin to long speeches than to short speeches, at least of the Socratic kind. We know there are short speeches in dramas, for example, but they are not Socratic short speeches. He turns then, the poet which he chooses is Simonides, as we will see immediately, and Simonides was one of the ancient sophists mentioned by Protagoras who concealed their being sophists. Simonides was said to be the first poet to write poetry for pay, which would also link him up with Protagoras, who taught virtue for pay. Lessing, the famous German critic of the 18th century, called Simonides, on the basis of all kinds of information, the Greek Voltaire, a view which is now universally rejected by classical scholars, but this does not necessarily prove that it is groundless. Good. Yes. So, in other words, Protagoras brings up now a way of handling things in which he believes he is likely to get back at Socrates to show his superiority. Yes.
And I propose to transfer the question which you and I have been discussing to the domain of poetry. We will speak as before, virtue.
So in other words, the subject matter will remain the same. Only the treatment will be different. Virtue, yes.
But in reference to a passage of a poet. Now, Simonides says to Scopas, the son of Creon, the Thessalian, it is with difficulty that, on the one hand, a man can become truly good, built foursquare in hands and feet and mind, a work without a flaw. Do you know the poem, or shall I repeat the whole? There is no need, I said, for I am perfectly well acquainted with the ode. I have made a careful study of it.
You see, yeah. So this simple triumph of merely better information is not given. So they're not given to Protagoras, yes?
Very well, he said.
that you did well, thank you. Yeah.
And do you think that the ode is a good composition and true? Yes, I said, both good and true. But if there is if there is a contradiction, can't the composition be good or true? No, not in that case, I replied.
Yeah. So Socrates thinks very highly of Simonides' poem. The standard of judgment which is common to Socrates and Protagoras is this: self-contradiction even in a poem is fatal. Okay? I believe no present-day poet would accept that. But Socrates and Protagoras agree as to that. I mean, not that different characters may not contradict one another any time, that's no difficulty. But the poet speaking in his own name may not contradict himself. This is a tough demand, yes?
And is there not a contradiction, he asked. Reflect. Well, my friend, I have reflected. And does not the poet proceed to say, I do not agree with the words of Pittacus, albeit the utterance of a wise man, with difficulty can a man be good? Now you will observe that this is said by the same poet who made the first statement. I know it. And do you think, he said, that the two sayings are consistent? Yes, I said, I think so. At the same time, I could not help fearing that there might be something in what he said. And you think otherwise? Why, he said, how can he be consistent in both? First of all, premising, as his own thought, it is with difficulty that a man can become truly good. And then, a little further on in the poem, forgetting and blaming Pittacus and refusing to agree with him when he says, with difficulty can a man be good.
Forgetting Pittacus, who had said the same thing as he had said. Yes. That it is hard to be all right, good. Isn't Greek not quite simple? Yes.
Which is the very same thing. And yet, when he blames him who says the same with himself, he obviously also blames himself, so that he must be wrong either in his first or his second assertion.
Protagoras proves that Simonides contradicts himself. Now, what is the use of that? Well, one could tentatively suggest, don't nail me down on that, if Simonides, notoriously a wise man, contradicts himself on virtue, why may not Protagoras too contradict himself regarding virtue without losing the epithet of wisdom? Perhaps there is also this possibility. Perhaps it is the same kind of contradiction, namely that Simonides said of one kind of virtue that it is difficult, and another kind that it is not difficult. And perhaps Protagoras means something by that, means something like that. I do not know. Go on.
Many of the audience cheered and applauded this.
You know, you see, many, he does not get universal acclaim. Why not? I cannot answer that question, but it should, the perfect interpreter should be able to answer it. There is one difficulty, incidentally. The poem by Simonides is not completely preserved. We know it the bit we know of it is chiefly known through the quotations here. This makes a minor difficulty. And perhaps not even a minor difficulty. Yes.
Well, when it says many, just 12, I suppose, but certainly Alcibiades wouldn't cheer. It looks like Socrates just reversed it.
That is the point. Yeah, that's the point. That you mean those who were simply following the party line. Yeah, that is possible. Yeah, good. All right, now let us see. The sequel is easier to understand.
Yes. And I felt at first giddy and faint, as if I had received a blow from the hand of an expert boxer when I heard his words and the sound of the cheering. And to tell you the truth, I wanted to get...
To whom does he say the truth?
The companion.
Yeah. You see, the narrated dialogue, he didn't say the truth there. Yes?
I wanted to get time to think what the meaning of the poet really was. So I turned to Prodicus.
Yeah,
and
you see Socrates lies again, of course. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
The line before, too, when he said, at the same time, I could not help fearing that there might be something in what he said. Because earlier he had said he had been perfectly familiar with the poem.
No, no, that is no doubt that he was perfectly familiar with the poem.
Yeah,
that
that's
is so.
But then when he paints this fear,
you know. Yeah, no, because after all, Socrates doesn't claim to be omniscient, and there might be a real difficulty which he had never had occurred to him. I think the description of the situation is very beautiful, yeah? Like someone knocked out. Socrates adopts the language of the agon, of the contest. Yeah? And Protagoras seems to have won at this point. Yes? Now? Then I turn to Prodicus. Yeah?
And quote him. Prodicus, I said, Simonides is a countryman of yours.
Let us say a fellow citizen. It's clearer.
Lanceman.
No, no, a fellow citizen.
A fellow citizen.
Comes from the same polis, yeah.
Of the same polis.
Yeah.
And you ought to come to his aid.
Literally, it is just for you to come, you know. It would be us, after all, concerned with justice. It is just for you to come to the aid of that hombre.
Yes. Just for you to come to his aid. I must appeal to you, like the river Scamander in Homer, who, when beleaguered by Achilles, summons Thesimachus to aid him, saying, Brother dear, let us both together stay the force of the hero. And I summon you, for I am afraid that Protagoras will make an end of Simonides.
Yeah. Now, Socrates compares Protagoras to Achilles. Now, Achilles is presented in the dialogue Hippias, the Lesser Hippias. Hippias, our friend Hippias. Achilles is called by Hippias, is preferred by Hippias to Odysseus, because Odysseus was a notorious liar, and Achilles never lies. He's absolutely honest. And this is a theme of this dialogue. And he compares Simonides to Scamandros and Prodicus to Simoais. But in a way, Socrates identifies himself with Simonides or Scamandros. Now, these are two rivers. This story is told in the 21st book of the Iliad. The two river gods fight Achilles and try to save Troy. And he compares himself and Prodicus and Simonides to these river gods. But Scamandros is finally defeated by Hephaestus, the god of the smithy, the helper of Achilles. What does this mean? Will Sistus anticipate that Simonides will be defeated by Protagoras, or at least by some immortal helper of Protagoras? We do not know. Let us see whether some of these things will become clear in the sequel. Yes?
Now is the time to rehabilitate Simonides by the application of your literary art, which enables you to distinguish will and wish, and make other charming distinctions like those which you drew just now.
In other words, will and wish, this distinction is not very pronounced in Greek. You know, that is of some importance, yeah.
And I should like to know whether you would agree with me, for I am of opinion that there is no contradiction in the words of Simonides. And first of all, I wish that you would say whether, in your opinion, Prodicus, being is the same as becoming. Not the same, certainly, replied Prodicus.
More. Different by Zeus, said Prodicus. One of the very rare oaths.
Different by Zeus, replied Prodicus. Did not Simonides first set forth as his own view that it would be with difficulty that a man can become truly good? Quite right, said Prodicus. And then he blames Pittacus, not as Protagoras imagines, for repeating that which he says himself, but for saying something different from himself. Pittacus does not say, as Simonides says, that with difficulty can a man become good, but with difficulty can a man be good. And our friend Prodicus would maintain that being, Protagoras, is not the same as becoming.
Yes, being and becoming are not the same as Prodicus here says. And I believe we would grant that without having the authority of Prodicus for that. Yes. And
if they are not the same, then Simonides is not inconsistent with himself. I dare say that Prodicus and many others would say, as Hesiod says, on the one hand, 'tis difficult for a man to become good, for the gods have made virtue the reward of toil. But
literally, the gods put sweat in front of virtue. Before you get to virtue, you have to sweat. Yes?
The gods put sweat before virtue. But on the other hand, when you have climbed the height, then to retain virtue, however difficult the acquisition, is easy.
Yeah. In other words, so what is sorcery? We don't see. Being is not becoming. And therefore, Simonides does not contradict himself. For he may have thought that it is difficult to become virtuous, to acquire the habit of virtue, to use later language, but easy to be virtuous. Once you are on that peak, or once you have acquired the habit of moderation regarding food, for example, it is very easy for you to be moderate. In other words, Socrates, Prodicus, Simonides, this strange triad, deny that being and becoming is the same. And Protagoras, by implication, asserts that being and becoming is the same, and therefore he makes that blunder in the interpretation of the Simonidean poem. And that there is such a connection between, there was a Greek philosopher Heraclitus who was said to have said, everything is in flux, like rivers, Heraclitus. And Protagoras is linked up with that school in the Platonic dialogue Theaetetus. So this is not an isolated point. Socrates, Simonides, Prodicus do not agree with this view that everything is in flux. But this makes it, however, more difficult. Why does he compare himself, or Prodicus, or Simonides, to the rivers, Kamandros, and Simois? That is very dark. And that remains completely dark for the time being. Incidentally, Prodicus's oath, which we have observed, is perfectly intelligible, I believe, in the context, because he has been called upon as a fellow citizen of Simonides. In Greek, you don't have a distinction between the term citizen or fellow citizen. Polites means both. If you say thy polites, means, of course, then thy fellow citizen. We cannot translate it differently in English. So, and citizens were more than purely theoretical men. Simple example, political orations on the one hand, and Euclid, oathless, on the other. Yes, we can read, I think, a bit more.
Prodicus heard and approved, but Protagoras said, your rehabilitation, Socrates, involves a greater error than is contained in the sentence which you are correcting. Alas, I said, Protagoras, then I am a sorry physician, and I do but aggravate a disorder which I am seeking to cure. Such is the fact, he said.
Yes.
How so, I asked. It would reflect great ignorance on the part of the poet, he replied, if he says that virtue, which in the opinion of all men is the hardest of all things, can be easily retained.
Now, if virtue were such a low thing that it could be said to be easily maintained. Now, there is a passage which I need now, which I want to go up. Protagoras says, in a word, Simonides cannot possibly have said what you, Socrates, suggest, namely that the possession of virtue is an easy thing, i.e. a low thing. You know what is easy? What is cheap? It's low. Yes. The valuable things are those which are hard to get by. No one pays any money for air. Although it is very valuable, as we all know, the possession of virtue must be a difficult thing. That's the objection. Now, of course, it raises one question on the basis of our previous reading. If virtue is such a difficult thing, and then the teaching of virtue also cannot be easy. Yeah? and what about the attractiveness for Buddha's teaching, but this is only in passing. So when Sugata says he is a still worse physician than illness, the illness, meaning self-contradiction is bad, but the depreciation of virtue would be still worse. Now let us read the next speech and then we conclude. Yes?
Well, I said, and how fortunate are we
By Zeus,
I said. And how fortunate are we in having Prodicus among us at the right moment. For he has a wisdom, Protagoras, which, as I imagine, is more than human and of very ancient date, and may be as old as Simonides, or even older. Learned as you are in many things, you appear to know nothing of this. But I know, for I am a disciple of Prodicus here. And now, if I am not mistaken, you do not understand the word difficult, kalakon, in the sense which Simonides intended. And I must correct you, as Prodicus corrects me when I use the word often.
No, say tremendous.
Tremendous.
To bring it closer to present American usage. Yeah.
Tremendous as a term of praise. If I say that Protagoras or anyone else is a tremendously wise man, he asks me if I am not ashamed of calling that which is good tremendous.
Yeah, does that make sense? Or terrific, you can also use.
Okay.
A terrific play. Used in the sense of a good play. It's absurd. And something perhaps more absurd than the Greek thing of which so is. Yes?
And then he explains to me that the term terrific is always taken in a bad sense, and that no one speaks of being terrifically healthy or wealthy or terrifical peace, but of terrific disease, terrific war, terrific poverty, meaning by the term terrific evil. And I think that Simonides and his countrymen the Chaeans, when they spoke of difficult, meant evil, or something which you do not understand. Let us ask Prodicus, for he ought to be able to answer questions about the dialect of Simonides.
Because they come from the same town.
Yes. What did he mean, Prodicus, by the term difficult? Evil, said
you see? Yes, go on.
And therefore, I said, Prodicus, he blames Pittacus for saying it is difficult to be good, just as if that were equivalent to saying it is evil to be good.
Yeah, sure. Beautiful. Well, Socrates says then difficult means bad. And Simonides said, of course, then that, Pythagoras then said that virtue is bad. I will give you one parallel which shows you this is not a mere joking matter. In the Republic, in the second book, A Diamond's Long Speech, near 364a, he says, consider further, Socrates, another kind of language about justice and injustice employed by both laymen and poets. All with one accord reiterate that moderation and justice are fair and honorable, to be sure, but difficult and laborious, while licentiousness and injustice are pleasant and easy to win. So, here we are. That is an price of virtue demands that one say that virtue is easy, i.e. pleasant. If you say virtue is difficult, i.e. unpleasant, then you drive people away from the pursuit of virtue. Surely this parallel from the Republic shows that there is much more to that than the mere attempt to parody Prodicus. We will take this up next time. Yes? You want to say that? I think this, there was no. You see here only again, and in this passage, how close Sugaris is to prodigals. I mean, that is not a very intimacy, but Sugaris is much closer to prodigals than to any other song. And to within limits and to some extent, Sugaris says nothing about the concern of prodigals with making it nice distinctions, although which doesn't prevent him from frequently ridiculing him as if it were a kind of mere mannerism of a prodigal. So I had hoped we could read much more today because we must finish the reading of the dialogue. Well, let us hope that we can do that.
I propose to read this.
Sure,
I'll do that.
Absolutely. Or as were you in the seminar on the laws last quarter?
No.
Yeah, well, there we discussed the same problem in a different form as it is suggested by Plato. Mind, not nous, nous in Greek, as distinguished from nomos, law. They are not the same. There is a certain kinship, but they are also different. But if you do not see both the kinship and the difference, you make mistakes, either by simply absolutizing the given nomos, or by destroying the possibility of nomos. Yeah?
You say at the same time there's a correspondence between modern day that there's only one legitimate.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, that's a good point, Charlie. Yeah, now let go. You?
Consideration, come back to the topic.
Yeah, yeah.
In such a point, why the officers discussed the theoretical life, the life of philosophy, and decides that this is only one half of virtue, and so far the philosopher doesn't harmony by that. He's reserved man, he has a healthy mind, he's a wise man. But on the other hand, it never does anyone any good. Isn't this idea of health and mind and virtue?
Why?
To deal with action with other people.
What do you mean it doesn't do him any good? What do you mean it doesn't do him any good?
Oh.
It doesn't earn money by that?
I went so far as, well, let's see. I don't know what Cicero says in that context. I think it's so far as his reference to his son. He said that perhaps this is an adequate expression of virtue. But simply to be wise, to be a wise man, a contemplative man, retire from civil life, retire from action with other people, this would be an adequate. You could not do this to be a virtuous man. You would also have to act virtuously.
That is a very sophisticated and very advanced question. We are now dealing with the lowest stratum. Now there are a number of things, I think of them as two of the things which occurred to me, which I should make here in addition. And the first is this. If we start from that crude notion of health of mind as it is presupposed in any psychiatric treatment, we must be clear of one thing. There was a man called Pascal who lived in the notion that there are abysses right here where he sits, neurotic. Well, to which one could of course very well say, and I believe one must, that while this may have been in this literal sense exaggerated, Pascal was a much healthier mind than those who do not see abysses anywhere, because he faced the crisis. Whereas a kind of mental health which is based on the assumptions that crises do not happen, or they will not happen to me on this kind of thing, is of course a very superficial help. That's number one. The other point which I would make to you is this, regarding metaphysics. That is really a very difficult question, and an important question. To what extent is what Cicero says here, or Plato also says, based on or deduced from a preceding metaphysics? I believe that the ambition of such men like Plato and Aristotle precisely was this, that what they taught or what they spoke of was an articulation, and the best articulation of which they were capable of what all men admit and see without seeing the implications. So I think it is necessary in their cases really to start from the very common phenomena which we all know and which are as accessible to us as they were to them, you know? Whereas, for example, such a doctrine like the Epicurean doctrine really is deduced from a certain cosmology which could not allow of any other criterion of good and bad except pleasant and painful. You see, in Aristotle, they are broader.
There's some necessity, though, isn't there, between the broader metaphysical view and the moral view?
Yeah, but the point is that this, as Aristotle has shown to perfection in his ethics, the references to his so-called metaphysical teaching are very few. And he begins by appealing to what well brought up men who have never had any theoretical study would understand. You know, there is that you can say there is a superiority of their metaphysics. Follows from the is shown by the fact that it allows this breadth. Yeah, you do not have to go through a certain emotions in order to understand their moral teaching. Huh?
I'm sorry, their metaphysics isn't open to any moral teaching,
though, is it? Well, it is not open to any moral teaching which does not find its most direct reflection in what a gentleman regards as proper. Sure, that's clear, but I would say in ordinary life, whom do we regard as authority in the really practical way? When we have practical questions, whom would we ask for advice? We would not ask graduates from Sing Sing in the first place. Secondly, we would not ask people who are quite honest in a simple sense, but who are not sophisticated in, you know, in human problems. Now, that man who is sophisticated and judges properly is what we mean by a gentleman. And so the practical test of the truth of a moral teaching from Plato's Aristotle point of view would be that its reflection in everyday life would be the gentleman. And that the Epicurean doctrine would not find its reflection in the gentleman. No? Now, Mr. Sassine, that's
and
the last question.
The notion of obligation with the notion of virtue. Do you mean to say that in writing this to his son, the author would say, well, this is fine, I mean, I want you to read this book well, and if you follow it, you'll be happy, but if you don't follow it, your reviews will be thoroughly vicious and unhappy, but that's okay?
No, and a contemptible, fellow.
Sure, I mean, which is still okay, I mean, it's up to you.
What is okay here? I mean, that is a question. I mean, that is, would you really, assuming, which could never happen to you personally, but let us just make a fiction, that a certain course of action you propose to a friend, and this, he says, when you do that, I will break off all relations with you and despise you for the rest of my days as an incredible fellow, I never thought you would do that. If you would say, oh, I don't care, that would not be your reaction. You would at least think twice.
Yeah,
Sure, I mean, I might think 100 times, except, okay. except the point I'm trying to make is that is there no conception, even on this level, of an obligation to be what your nature calls me to be?
Yeah, but when is the question? What is then the question of obligation? What's the difference? Meaning, must you have rewards and punishments in addition to the intrinsic goodness or badness of the action? That would be one. Then you have a clear distinction that this obligation is that part of your concern which is related to the rewards and punishments. That is not
true.
So what is it? I mean, is it the consideration that you do that what is right, not only because it is demanded by the dignity of man, as one could say, or the dignity of a wise man, or do you do it for the sake of the glory of God? Theoretically distinguishing element in your choice. Yeah. You know, then would the obligation element come in from that reference to God?
Well, why can the obligation come in from just simply a reference to my nature? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I would say, surely my own, the question with which we are primarily concerned is now, whether it comes in scissor. Yeah. And now, and that is the question. I mean, that is the question which is raised explicitly by Collingwood, the question that we get. That's all that is made. You know? And that's the question that comes from. No, the practical meaning I believe is this. Whether this notion of virtue, as I try to sketch it here, implies with necessity something like hands of conscience. You know, I mean, from the point of view of which I sketched, that is not implied. Let us take a clever crook, I mean, who is shrewd enough never to confront the question of the law, and there will be no crisis in his life. Okay? He goes through his life and has been happy. At least not more unhappy than we all are. Or maybe even. He has never had a moment kind of conscience if he took away money from orphans and widows and whatever. Well, I say this very seriously. Such a thing. Still, and perhaps no one will ever know what a crook is. So he's regarded as a respectable citizen, maybe elected him to all kinds of public office. I believe that is happening. Good. What do you say to such a case? He never for a moment had pangs of conscience. He would remain, and he is even unable to see himself in the mirror. And so he is really satisfied. I assume that there are some. Still, one would say, if a man of judgment could know him, and his spirit could know his mind, he would despise him. And that's all there is to it. You know, there is no intrinsic necessity that the lower actions, the evil action, will be punished, necessarily followed a man's punishment. At least that's one's point.
Well, I was just wondering, and then the question I would ask, is the concept of punishment, you know, felt punishment in some way or other, necessarily tied in with the notion of obligation? If I would say it seems to me it's not.
No. Yeah, then indeed we become, then you, one can say the distinction between virtue as I try to describe it and moral obligation as you understand it has disappeared. This is clear, but I don't, but I say this now on the basis of our present discussion. I have a hunch that somewhere there is a difference. But maybe we find out this border, maybe we won't. But, so then I'm willing to accept your point. But then still I would say this remarkable that this term is not used. Opikia means that the right action in the highest sense, which is not discussed in this book as such, and the appropriate action, appropriate to a non-wise man. So the or at least the, the right action is seen in the perspective of an imperfect man. That is all as emphasis and obligation.
If for no other reason, at least for that of self-preservation, I have not stopped.